Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome to Frap How. We're your hosts, Odd and Rags. I'm excited for today's interview.
Yeah, I am too, because I'm always really excited to interview our friends, because I think that they're really wonderful and interesting, and I love being able to, like, show everybody else how cool and interesting our friends are.
It's like show and tell with
yes,
our friends.
Yes, exactly. Exactly like that. Yeah, but this week we are interviewing our friend Sam, who identifies as a non-binary lesbian. Their pronouns are they, them. They also work in wildlife conservation, mainly rehabilitating sick and injured wild birds. And they also are pharmacy tech. Like, they do 1 million things. They are also chronically ill, and we talk a lot about that during this episode. And more importantly, they have really cool like hobbies that they do. They do ink drawings, printmaking, they crochet and make resin jewelry. They have a really awesome Etsy that people should check out.
I do want to give a content warning. We talk about some graphic physical health stuff. So if you are easily skeeved out, this might not be the episode for you. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
So we start everybody off with a nice little slow pitch. Tell us about yourself.
Okay. As you guys know, or people listening may not, my name is Sam. I'm 21. I'm a senior in college, and I'm getting a BS in biology. I planned to go into wildlife conservation, and I actually already work in the field. I'm a lesbian, and my pronouns are they, them. I currently rehab injured and sick birds. I love birds. They're kind of like my heart and soul. And I'm also a pharmacy tech on the side. I'm chronically ill and disabled, and I have hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, POTS, and gastroparesis, and I also recently got diagnosed with a selective IgA immunodeficiency. I'm also an artist, and I do lots of ink drawings and printmaking, and I crochet and just do a lot of fun stuff, but that's me in a nutshell. I also have 3 cats, and that's really important.
That was one of the most verbose and well-worded intros we've had in a while.
I just like talking about myself.
Yeah, it literally is like almost word for word what you sent us for your bio.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it literally is. I'm very, very impressed with you.
Things well, just stick in my
I
brain.
What I find even more impressive is that most people have the hardest time introducing themselves. And you're just like, I got this.
I like the sound of my own voice. What can I say?
That makes one of us in this conversation. That's fair. Also, I do want to point out that this is like where all of our like interviews are always coming full circle. And I just want to point out that Sam's Etsy account is called Cottage Core, which I learned from Ravicky.
Oh, right.
Yes, it's Cottage Core Co. I crochet mushrooms. That was like my original thing, but I make resin jewelry now too.
I just learned what cottagecore was, and I don't know where I've been, but like now I feel very hip, and I like know how to look it up on TikTok. That's the extent of it.
I do like how we go full circle.
Yeah, there you go. We're bringing it around.
So, well, there's so many things from your introduction that we can talk about.
I'm interested in how you, like, have come to identify yourself as a non-binary lesbian. I hear this this being asked of people a lot in our greater LGBTQ plus community. And you know, that's not how I identify, so I can't answer that question. I obviously think everybody can call themselves whatever the fuck they want, but I'm curious for you, how did you like end up finding that label fit for you, at least for now?
It was actually like a pretty, I don't want to say recent realization, like within the past year or so. But like I came out as a lesbian when I was like 14. I had like that part of my life figured out like super young. I never really struggled with like my sexuality, but I definitely struggled with my gender. And like I never felt connected to womanhood like at all. And then I started like thinking about it like really hard in the past year. And I was like, I feel like the reason why I don't fully connect to womanhood is because like in our society, I think that femininity is inherently performed for men by a lot of women. And while I am very feminine, I don't perform my femininity to men. It's exclusively for women. And I feel like my experience with womanhood is so different from that of a straight woman that I don't consider myself in that, like, the gender binary. Like, I'm not what a typical woman would be because I lack that attraction to men. And I think that, like, recently, a lot of lesbians I've talked to kind of feel the same way. And I know that, like, non-binary lesbianism has always been a thing within the lesbian community with, like, the gender identities of, like, butch and femme. And, like, I don't fit into either of those. I'm not incredibly masculine and I'm not incredibly feminine. But the way I do present myself is for women. So I'm non-binary because I'm not a woman, but I'm also not a man. I'm just a lesbian. And you know that meme of the dog and he's like, no take, only throw. And he won't let the person take the ball from him. That's me with my gender. I'm like, no gender, only lesbian. That's it. I'm just gay. I just like women.
That's fair.
And non-binary people.
Yeah. I'm all about it. I just think it's interesting. Like, I'm meeting more people like who are coming out as non-binary, who have already identified as non-binary. And just like hearing how they talk about their sexuality, obviously different, very different than gender, but it's like, you know, I thought I was the only one that was like thinking about these two things that are so separate. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. that's not true. I have a degree in gender studies. Like, it makes no sense that I think that, but like, it just makes me feel like I love hearing about all of everybody's like little journeys.
I like talking about it. It's just like, I've never been able to separate them, you know, like it's always been like one entity, like my gender and sexuality. They've never been like a separate thing for me.
Yeah, I think that is like a really interesting way to look at it, because I think as I've become like more comfortable with my gender identity and then also like my sexuality, that I've like become less feminine. And I love femininity. I take a lot of strength from my femininity, but also like my outward, like you're saying that like performance part of it, that has really changed for me. And I think as someone who identifies as bi or pan, like that has been a very interesting thing to like navigate. So, like, as a bi or pan person, I just don't like the word pansexual, and I don't like the flag as much as I like the bi flag, so we're just going to say bi. Anyway, that they face a lot of discrimination within the community, and so I think I always felt really, like, I was always, like, kind of monitoring that piece, and then all mm-hmm. the stuff started coming up around, like, my gender identity, and it was, like, how that intersects with those two is so, like, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it until, like, a couple of years ago.
It's okay. You're still ahead of the curve, because I still meet people who are like, how can you be non-binary and a lesbian? And it just, like, makes me pinch the bridge of my nose. You know what I mean?
It's like, because I am.
There's still people that are like, if you're not a woman, you can't be a lesbian. And I'm like, lesbianism is about the lack of attraction to men. So, like, yeah. If I'm not a man and I'm not attracted to men, I'm a lesbian.
But also, can we talk about, like, how you use a label to define yourself is appropriate?
Yes.
It's like a cat. You don't put the cat in the box. the cat puts himself in a box.
Exactly.
And that's okay. If as long as you're putting yourself into your labeled box, that's okay. Somebody else doing it can go fuck off.
Yeah, it's like how I'll call myself queer, but I hate when other people call me queer, because like a lot of times, specifically in the case of lesbians, people will call us queer women in order to avoid saying the word lesbian because they think it's dirty or bad or whatever. So I'll call myself a queer person, but if someone else calls me queer, I'm just like, please say lesbian. Please just call me a lesbian. It's not a bad word. You can say it.
Well, so I think that's like a really interesting way to segue into like talking about the oppression that you feel within the community, because you are a non-binary lesbian, but you also have a disability.
Yeah. A lot of people don't think about the intersection between like gender issues and sexuality issues and disability and how they could possibly be related. But
do disabled people have sex?
Obviously not. We're not capable. All jokes aside, they both like, I have, you know, like body issues relating to gender and then also body issues like relating to disability. And it's like how much those actually affect each other, you know?
So, but can you elaborate on that? Like, do you feel comfortable elaborating a bit more on what that is like? Because I think a lot of people might not actually even be able to put those pieces together unless you literally force it in front of them.
Definitely. I think that specifically as a non-binary person, people have this idea in their head that non-binary people have to be like this thin, white, able-bodied, like, twink, basically.
Yeah, like a prepubescent boy.
Yeah. Just like a really masculine woman or a feminine man. Like, that's what they think non-binary people are. And they expect you to fit this box, and if you look any more feminine or any more masculine, or if you have curves or things like that, people are like, okay, you don't look non-binary because you're not in the middle androgynous. And like, being non-binary isn't being in the middle, it's being outside the binary. And I think my whole life I've like felt pressured to look like that, because in order to like validate myself in a way. And I also, like, I have body dysmorphia relating to my gastroparesis, because I haven't been able to control my weight for most of my life. I go through periods of, like, extreme weight loss and then gaining it back and then losing weight again. And it just, like, I've never really felt good about myself because of it. And, like, I'm at a place in my life where I'm at peace and I'm like, whatever. I love my body. It's trying its best. But before I got here, it was like, okay, I have this pressure on one side to look a certain way, but I have this fear on the other side of looking sick. And people will only think my gender is valid if I don't have curves and if I like don't have what they consider a feminine body. But on the other side, I have such bad body dysmorphia and I think I look so ill when I'm thin. And I want to have those curves and I want to have that meat on my bones. So I don't have such horrible feelings about myself. And so I don't look what I thought was looking sick. And it's just like weird pressure from these two different areas of my life telling me different things. And it took me a very long time to like, number one, realize that like I don't have to present a certain way to be non-binary. And it also took me a long time to realize that I have body dysmorphia, because I didn't put a word to that until like my therapist told me last year. But I'm definitely in a much better place about it. Ever since I did get diagnosed with gastroparesis last year, I've been able to get weight restored and control my weight, which has been really nice, but it took me a very long time to get diagnosed with it. So before that, I was just losing weight everywhere, and I was like, what's going on? And it was not fun. But yeah, sorry for that long rambling explanation.
No, I thought that was actually like really insightful, because like as people who are gender neutral, and also like we do, I think it's fair to say for Odd as well that like we both have our own body image issues. Like there is that factor playing into it, but then also, at least for me, my body image issue is not connected to my chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I live with somebody who's exploring the possibility of having the same thing that you have. So, like, I can see how that can affect, because it can really like give you this warped perception of your body.
Definitely.
You know?
I think that what's really interesting is that like talking about the difference between like body dysmorphia and then also like gender dysphoria for me has like been an issue that's been coming up a lot lately, and trying to manage those two as well, like, and connecting it all, like, obviously, like, connects to gender and sexuality and, like, your health. And it is, like, so hard to find a body that feels right for you, and then also a body that is, like, validated by, like, the outside world. Because as much as I want to admit that I don't give a fuck about that, it obviously is, like, important to just, like, be accepted and valued.
I think we all do to a certain extent. It's like,
yeah,
it's hard to exist in this world without caring like what people think, no matter how much you say that you don't. Everyone does. And then the other thing was, I didn't realize I had gender dysphoria until I experienced gender euphoria, and I was like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to feel about myself. That's new.
So when did that happen? Like, what was going on for you?
So last year was like a year of a lot of change in my life. I went through the death of someone very close to me. I got diagnosed, with an immunodeficiency. I tried one of the only treatments for gastroparesis, and it didn't work. And it was just like a very not great, few months. And at the time I was also really struggling with like my body image and like my gender identity. And I was dating this girl at the time, who identified as a lesbian. And I told her, like, hey, I think I might not be a woman. And it, like, turned into this whole thing, because she was like, that invalidates my identity as a lesbian. And I kind of forced myself into the closet because of it, because I'm borderline. I didn't want to lose her. and then when we ended up breaking up, I, like, felt very liberated. And I was like, I can present however I want now. And, like, I shaved half my head and, like, I bought all new underwear. That was like huge. I was like, I'm so tired of this like lacy, frilly stuff. Like, I bought all like boy shorts and stuff like that. I stopped wearing a bra, and I felt so good about myself, and I felt so comfortable in it. And it was also the first time I like let all my body hair just grow wild. The only reason I didn't before is because my mom was on my ass about it. I started doing all these things that like kind of validated my disconnection from womanhood. And I felt so good. And I was like, I realized that something was wrong before, but I didn't realize how wrong it actually was until I experienced like comfort in looking at myself, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mine is when I, you know, like you, it's like finding a literal like outfit that you just like really love and you feel comfy in, and you look in the mirror and you're also like, I look really good. I mean, it is literally that also, but like it is something you can't really describe before it happens.
Yeah,
definitely. And even then it's still really hard to describe.
Yeah.
To some people.
Yeah, it's hard to find the words to describe dysphoria or euphoria when it comes to gender. It's just like a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize that it was, like, weird to, like, not connect with, like, parts of your body. Like, I would just, like, look at myself and be like, that's not what I, like, imagine in my brain when I'm looking at myself. But then somebody, you know, like, people you care about are like, no, you're beautiful just the way you are. Like, I didn't understand, like, that was a disconnect. And I was like, mm-hmm. And when I realized that, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
That explains so much. It's funny because, like, for the longest time, I had boy shorts. And I would just wear them for, like, the last, like, 5 or 6 years. And then, like, within, like, the last year, and I'm like, oh, maybe I missed, like, a few signs that, like, I just weren't paying attention to. I'm really good about denial.
No, I'm telling you. I mean, and I can't take credit for this at all. But, you know, it is like life puts pamphlets under your door, and they're just there for you whenever you're ready. Someone said that to me, and I was like, yes, I can see that now.
I look back to being a kid, and like, I've always loved animals. And when I was a kid, I just loved pretending to be them. And I'd always tell my mom that whatever animal I was a boy. Like, I was never a girl when I was pretending to be an animal. And I'm like, wow, I should have thought about that critically, like, a lot earlier in my life.
Yeah, like, when I would play with, like, dolls or whatever, I would always wanting to play with, like, the boy dolls specifically. Like, I always wanted even my Legos, because, like, you can always just switch the hair. No, they had to be boys.
I know, me being, like, 7 and ripping the Vanessa Hudgens poster out of my, like, J14 magazine and putting it on my wall and looking at it every night before I went to bed.
She's just so
definitely
beautiful.
Definitely not a lesbian.
Just so beautiful.
But she's so talented, Mom.
I want her to be my pal. You know, just gal pals.
Gal pals.
The funny thing about that is when I was in, like, the 8th grade and first dealing with, like, mental health issues, I didn't want to go to school. And my mom was like, is it because you're gay? And I was so offended. I was like, what do you mean? Why would you ever say that to me? And then within the next 2 years, I came out as a lesbian.
You're like, oh, yeah, okay. Maybe not the right approach, but correct.
She was right.
Like, damn it. Do you always have to be right, Mom?
Unfortunately.
What has it been like, though, for you navigating relationships and also, like, having a disability? I mean, I know we're talking about gender and stuff, but I'm imagining that creates another level of, like, issues and, like, hurdles to navigate through.
It definitely does. It complicates just about everything and every part of every relationship I've ever been in. For most of my formative teenage years, I dated a girl that I met in an outpatient therapy program. Don't do that. My biggest piece of advice to anyone is don't date the people you meet in therapy. But anyway, I dated this girl in high school, and it was when I was just starting to get really sick. And it was also, like, right after I came out as a lesbian and, like, went really hardcore with, like, dressing how I thought a lesbian should dress. And things like that. And it just, like, it created this weird, I don't know, this weird rift in my own brain of, like, I don't know how to be in a relationship. Like, I want to be in a relationship in the same way that everyone else is, but I'm always afraid that, like, my partner is going to have to be my caretaker. And this was something that was in my head from, like, 15, my first relationship ever. Like, this was something I was worrying about. And then when that relationship blew up in my face, I later got diagnosed with EDS, and which was a huge punch in the gut, because before that I was told that I had Lyme disease and I would get better, and then to turn around and be like, okay, here's a genetic illness that only gets worse.
Congratulations.
I was like, oh shit. Right?
Mazel tov.
And then, like, the first thing I thought about is, like, if I get married to someone, are they gonna end up, like, having to be my caretaker? And that has always been a big fear of mine, and I chalk that up to internalized ableism, because that is, like, I'm not a burden, and disabled people aren't a burden, and we're not a burden on the people in our lives, in our relationships. And that anybody I'm in a relationship with has to understand that and agree with me on that as well, because, like, my last serious relationship, the girl I also had issues with my gender, a big part of the reason we broke up is because she, like, feared having to become my caretaker, because I was really not doing well with my health when we were dating. And it just, like, I'm already mentally ill. And that just, like, destroyed my sense of self-worth, because I would just look at myself and be like, okay, like, I'm just going to be a burden on everyone I meet. They're going to have to take care of me. Like, people can't cook for me because, like, my digestive system is so bad, and, like, I can't go on fun trips because of this or that. And I just, like, always have this excuse as to why, like, things would never work out in my life and why everyone around me would, like, not ever want to be around me, even platonically. And that took a lot of therapy to, like, overcome. And it's definitely still a seed of doubt that's, like, always in the back of my mind. Like, hey, you're a burden. And then I'm like, no, I'm not, because I'm really not. This is just, like, my life. And I don't know. I just, like, I have different needs than other people, and that's okay, because everyone I meet has different needs than the last person I met. And I think that it needs to be viewed like that instead.
I just want to let you know that your EDS does not make you special. I have depression and anxiety, and I feel like a burden too. So,
valid. Don't we all?
No, I mean,
that's a good way to look at it, though, because I feel like everyone has that thing that they're like, oh, I have this going on, so I'm a burden.
I know, but I think with your, with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, that it is like, it is obviously something that is degenerative. Like, it is very likely that, I mean, you're going to need a caretaker at some point, and that is, I can understand that that comes with a lot of already guilt built into that, no matter who you have to ask that of.
Definitely. When I was in high school and I was dating that girl, her dad had ALS, and she would just constantly dump on me how hard it was for her, like, to have a disabled father. And that really, like, that really, like, stuck in my brain. And, like, that's always there. And I'm like, one day I'm going to be, like, someone's disabled parent. And, like, are they going to hate me for it? You know? Because she would always tell me, like, I wish my dad would just die. And I thought it was horrible. And I still think it's horrible. Because, like, what the hell? But, and then in the back of my mind, I'm just like, oh, shit. Like, is my kid going to hate me for being disabled? You know? But then I also see, like, my peers, other peers who have disabled parents. And they're normal. It's not anything weird to them. So I'm like, maybe she was just a bad person. You know?
I'm pretty sure it's that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm also probably willing to bet that, like, she's probably also hearing it from other people in her household, like the adults that are talking about that, you know? Because, like, disability is very much real. It very much does have its effects on the people around you who are living their life shared with you. But if this is, like, a general understanding, and this is something that's communicated, and this is something that, like, is just the norm, then it's just that. It's just the norm. And, like, why does it have to be made into a bigger deal than it is, you know?
Exactly. And I feel like a lot of it comes down to, like, the different models of disability. Like, the social versus medical model. Like, as a society, we see disabled people and we're like, okay, that's wrong. We need to fix that. But, like, when in reality, it's not an issue with the person. It's an issue with, like, the inaccessibility around us. So I just, the whole world needs, like, a little bit of a perspective shift, and then it'll be fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Something that, like, really kind of resonated with me was when Stephen Hawking passed away, and everybody's like, oh, he's free now. And it's like, no, his wheelchair was his freedom. You know, like, his wheelchair was the tool that he used to communicate and live his life. Him being dead does not equate freedom. That, like, what kind of message are you passing on to the disability community, who, by the way, are able to think for themselves, view themselves, and you talk like absolute trash around them and they can fucking hear you?
Yeah, that shit pisses me off. It's like when people say wheelchair bound, and it's like, okay, like, that's implying that, like you said, that's the thing that's limiting the wheelchair, but it's not. That's the thing that's giving disabled people our freedom, you know? Like, our mobility aids get us to where we need to be. They don't limit us in any way.
Right. Yeah, it's just something that kind of has, over time, boggled my mind and also, like, struck with me the more that I sat with it. I'm just like, what? These people can hear you. They understand you. Stop dehumanizing.
Yeah, I now I don't need to use a mobility aid thanks to, like, so much physical therapy. But there's a period of a few years where I used a cane or a rollator or a wheelchair for long distances. And I just remember going to New York City once, and I was in a wheelchair. And I was with my freshman year roommate, and we were in the, like, the disabled section, the accessible section of the train going into the city. And I pulled out the tickets on my phone when the conductor came around, and she was like, oh, honey, like, your caretaker doesn't need a ticket. And I was like, what? And then she turned to my friend and was like, you don't have to buy a ticket if you're here taking care of her. And I was just sitting there like, oh my God. I don't know. People see someone with a disabled person and they're like, okay, that must be their caretaker because disabled people can't have any sort of relationship.
I also want to point out, though, that New Jersey Transit, they let the nuns that work at St. Elizabeth's ride the train for free. So it's just like, who knows what rules they're following?
That's true.
All the rules.
I'm like, what? Anyway, that's a separate discussion. It's not that they're not equal situations. I just am confused about why nuns get to ride for free.
New Jersey Transit is just something that is impossible to understand to anyone, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how has that impacted your college at school? I mean, your college at school. Your your ability to go to school or get accommodations, because I know so a few people in my family have learning disabilities, and also I have a family member who is deaf, and so I've been learning a lot about accommodations because then now they're all going to university and sort of and things like that. And I know that that was those things, which that seems pretty simple, they have been diagnosed. Or, my cousin is I can't hear you, I'm deaf, clearly. And those accommodations feel very easy. But for you, it seems like it is very multifaceted. So what are some things that you do need to be able to get to class or keep up with your peers? And what things does your school, not have?
Okay, so I've definitely had to fight for a lot of things. The biggest thing for me is one, access, being able to physically get to class with no obstacles, and then dealing with class during flares, because the nature of my illness is that it does flare up. I have weeks where I'm stuck in bed. I have weeks where I'm stuck in bed because I'm throwing up everything I eat, and I'll faint if I stand up. So when I first started, they told me that they didn't have an official accommodation for occasional absences, and that was something I would have to work out on my own with professors. And that was very frustrating. And then the other thing was my campus isn't entirely accessible because of a lot of it is considered historical buildings. And under ADA, buildings built before a certain time don't have to be accessible. Also, they have a really bad asbestos problem, so they refuse to do any construction. So the access issue became less of an issue for me throughout the last 4 years as my mobility has improved, but I still see it as a huge issue for my peers who I go to school with who are also disabled. I have a friend who has a different connective tissue disease than me, but she had a class on the fourth floor of a building that didn't have an elevator, and they couldn't move it for her because she contacted the professor and the dean, and she was like, listen, I can't access this class. I cannot climb stairs. And she ended up having to drop the class because they weren't willing to move the location. And while that hasn't been as much of an issue for me, I did dorm my freshman year, and I lived in an inaccessible building, which was not fun. And I requested to live on the first floor for that reason, and they ended up putting me on the second floor and told me that one flight of stairs should be fine because I'm not in a wheelchair.
Oh my God.
And that was a huge issue. But I eventually gave up the fight because I was like, you know what, whatever. I could handle one flight of stairs at the time, and I just wasn't worth the energy.
But it's the principle of the thing.
I know.
Let me tell you what your disability can and cannot handle.
Right. They're like, oh, you're not in a wheelchair, so you should be able to climb stairs. And I was like, actually, I have two pins in my back and can't lift my knees like that. since then, I actually got the pins removed because that stabilization surgery was botched and my scar tissue pushed the pins out of place. So that's besides the point. The other big issue was the fact that they wouldn't give me an accommodation to be able to work remotely or have absences excused. And actually, I've worked out with most professors. If I don't come to class, they get it as long as I email them. But it's just I was forced to put myself in this incredibly vulnerable situation with every single professor I've ever had and disclose to them the exact nature of my disability and everything I go through and tell them exactly what I'm flaring up and what's going on, and just like tell them things I don't want to share with them because they're my professor. It should be professional. So that's been really frustrating, especially now that with coronavirus, Seton Hall so easily switched to remote learning. And that was something they told me wasn't possible 3 years ago when I first started here. And like, I don't know, I'm just like, wow, you switched to remote learning for literally the entire student body and you can't even do that for like a handful of disabled people on campus that can't make it to campus sometimes. It's just, it shows where their priorities lie and how, like, obviously it's something they could do. They just didn't want to put the effort into it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just like when it snows, you know, like on campus, that it, I would see them just like not clean off any of the ramps or push all of the snow in front of one of the ADA entrances. Mm-hmm. Like, you're missing the, like, what the fuck? Like, you're missing the point of, like, even having these things. You're just, like, creating obstacles for people. Like, now they have to be like, well, I can't go to class because I can't cross the street or get on the bus or whatever because people put snow there. You know, like...
That,
yeah.
And I guess part of the issue is people don't realize that things are an issue until they experience it or someone close to them experiences it. Because, like, I, even myself, like, I consider myself, like, a disability advocate, but until I actually became disabled by my illness, I didn't think about any of these things. And I think that just, like, I don't know, says something about, like, our education system. We should be taught about these things and not leave it up to chance to learn about them.
Yeah, like, let's start talking about empathy early on and why it's important. So in talking about kind of, like, how your disability has opened up your eyes to like the wide variety of issues that can affect disabled people. Like, how did you get diagnosed? Like, what was that journey like? Because I know from my, like, I mean, listening to you and then also to other people who think that they might have an assortment of genetic disorders, it seems really difficult to get diagnosed and like really frustrating.
It was like an 8-year long shit show with no breaks. So I, as a kid, I had a lot of symptoms. Looking back, I had a lot of symptoms of EDS, but kids are naturally very hypermobile. Kids get injured. They, you know, like people don't look at a kid breaking their arm or like having multiple dislocations and think, oh, there's something wrong with that. They just think, okay, kids are just little monsters that hurt themselves all the time.
Yeah.
So I didn't, like, it didn't process in my mind that there was something wrong with me until maybe I was like 12. And I started having these like debilitating migraines and like vomiting episodes. And it kind of escalated from there. At the same time, I was dealing with like my mental health blowing up. So that was very complicated because I was like, how many of these things are just like physical symptoms of my anxiety and my trauma manifesting themselves? And how many of these things are actually like unrelated and a physical illness? And that took a very long time to figure out because I didn't actually get diagnosed with anything until I was 15, a few years later.
Jeez.
Someone my mom knew said that her son had Lyme disease and that it was an avenue that we should consider looking down. So we did, and we found a so-called Lyme literate doctor who ended up diagnosing me with Lyme disease. I did test positive for it, so I did have it at one point, but I don't think it was appropriate the way she treated it because... Mm-hmm. I stayed with her until I was 17, so that was like 2 solid years of getting continuous treatment for Lyme disease, which included a shit ton of oral antibiotics, antiparasitics. I got IV antibiotics 3 times a week.
Oh my God.
And it was horrible. I was so sick. I got so much worse than I was, and she told me that was a good thing. She said that it was my body reacting to all the dead bacteria in me. And that it was a good thing that I was getting worse. And it got to the point where she told me she would no longer treat me unless I got a central line to continue my IV antibiotic treatment. And that's when I was kind of just like, okay, I know I was really desperate for answers, but maybe this isn't it, because it was 2 years of hell. And now she wanted to put a tube into my heart, and I was not okay with that.
Oh my God.
I went to a different infectious disease specialist who, you know, did my blood work, did my physical exam, and was like, listen, like, you probably had Lyme disease at one point. Once you test positive for it, you're going to keep testing positive for it because it's an antibody test. So all the blood work that doctor had been ordering that showed that I still had Lyme disease was not valid. So this doctor was like, okay, why don't you try a rheumatologist? And I was like, not into the idea at first, because when I was like, right before I got diagnosed with Lyme disease, I went to a rheumatologist who told me that like it was my mental health and that it was like my anxiety manifesting itself as like these vomiting and joint pain and things like that. And like, while that's a valid thing that can happen, that wasn't what was happening with me. So went to this rheumatologist and he did a physical exam. And he was like, two things. Your skin is really stretchy, and my finger straight up dislocated when he was testing my range of motion. And then the other thing was, I have like a ridiculous medical history of organ prolapse, pelvic floor dysfunction, and just like a shit ton of dislocations in my childhood. And he was like, yeah, I don't know how anyone's ever looked at this and thought it was like normal. So he sent me to a geneticist. At this point, I was 18. So it was a few years. But anyway, the geneticist diagnosed me with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome clinically, because I met all the clinical criteria, and then sent off my genetic test, which insurance didn't cover, by the way. It was so expensive.
They covered they cover the fucking like BRCA gene test. Like, what?
Yeah. They wouldn't cover this test, and it was a few thousand dollars.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What do you mean by clinically diagnosed? Because how you made it sound was that, like, there's also another diagnosis that wouldn't be clinically diagnosed.
So hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is the only type that doesn't have a gene linked to it, so you can only be clinically diagnosed with it. So gotcha. It was a preliminary diagnosis until the genetic test ruled out all the other types. So when my genetic test came back, I had one of the genes for a different type, but I didn't have that type because for classical like EDS, it's recessive. So you need two copies of a mutation on the TNXB gene. I have one copy, so I didn't qualify for that diagnosis. So I'm still on the hypermobile label, but it's an unclassified gene related to EDS. And I think about 20% of people with hypermobile have that gene. So it's either the gene for hypermobile type or it's its own type, but I guess it doesn't matter. The treatment's the same. But after that happened, it was like devastating and also really great at the same time. Cause I was like, okay, I went from having this like curable disease that I thought I had and I thought would get better eventually to having this like degenerative genetic illness that I can't do anything about. And I felt very helpless, but at the same time, I had this newfound, like, I don't know, like, I was so relieved that I finally had, like, the thing that was wrong with me, and I was like, yes, this is it. Little did I know that was not it. There was still more, but...
But wait, there's more.
Yes, there's always more.
There is more. After that, I ended up getting diagnosed with POTS, which was something... It was a diagnosis that had always been on the table, but... I don't know. It just like never came to fruition, mostly because I didn't want to go to a cardiologist because I had a really bad experience with one once. So I got diagnosed with that. Originally I was told that I had just like really bad IBS and cyclic vomiting syndrome. And then when I finally went to a gastroenterologist after getting diagnosed with EDS, they decided to test me for gastroparesis because they're comorbid. And I got a gastric emptying study done. And they were like, congrats, after 4 hours, you emptied 10% of your stomach when you should have emptied 90. And I was like, great, what do I win? And they were like, an incurable disease.
Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, I love it.
But also, it was another one of those things that I was like, this is actually great because now I can, like, manage it.
Yeah, I mean, because you know what it then, is. Yeah.
Exactly. I got diagnosed with EDS when I was 18, and I am 21 now, so it's been a few years. I've done 3 years of really intense, 3 times a week physical therapy, and I've gotten a lot of my mobility back. And since getting diagnosed with gastroparesis, I, like, implemented a bunch of dietary changes, and I'm on Zofran, so I'm, like, managing it, but it's still not great. It's probably my biggest issue right now.
So, I mean, you're throwing a lot of, like, different things at me, and I would love to break it. I mean, I know what they mean, but most people don't know what they mean. So
that's true.
Why don't you explain a little bit about, like, what hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS, is for you, like, what that looks like, and then kind of start going down the line? Because I think that one is obviously the biggest one that sort of everything else flows into.
Yeah, that's like the pot of water that everything is growing out of. But basically, for me, it's a very diverse illness, so I can only speak to my experience. But for me, it looks like joint dislocations in all my joints. I have joint damage because of it. I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is comorbid with it. And I'm convinced that all the antibiotics I was on for all those years, like, progressed to my RA, because antibiotics are linked to autoimmune disease. So I have really bad joint damage from the combination of those two things. A huge thing for my EDS is my history of organ prolapse. Not to get graphic, but I've had a bladder prolapse, I've had a cervical prolapse, and I've had a rectal prolapse, which was really gross and not fun.
I mean, no prolapse is a good one. And
that was the worst one, though.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
And my whole pelvic floor is prolapsed. And when people ask me what that means, I'm like, okay, imagine all your organs sitting in a hammock. And the hammock is really loose, because that's what's going on in me.
And that's because you're... Sorry. No, it's okay. It's because EDS has to do with your connective tissue, and
yes,
your pelvic floor is a connective tissue.
Exactly. Yeah, EDS is a group of disorders affecting the genes that create connective tissue in various ways, usually collagen, but... My gene affects tenascin, which is another very important structural protein. And connective tissue is basically like ligaments, tendons, most of the tissue holding your organs together, fascia, your skin. My skin is super stretchy and super soft. You know, nothing important.
Just like things that hold you together. Important. It's like all the glue.
Yeah, it's the glue. And mine is super loose. But you know, one of the clinical criteria for EDS is velvety soft skin. So... Who's the real winner? It's me.
You know, that's you have that going for you.
It's so great. And I just remember, like, before I was diagnosed, showing people how stretchy my skin was. And they were like, what's going on there? And I'd be like, I don't know.
But isn't it cool?
It is cool. I like hiding quarters under my skin. Like a magic trick. I've seen it. You have seen it.
It's pretty gross.
Oh, it's delightful.
And so and sorry, continue your list of things, because I think it's one very interesting, because I was raised by two people in the medical field, so anything having to do with the body is awesome. And then also I just like hearing it from Sam in particular.
Oh, I love you.
They're nosy. That's what they're saying.
I'm also super nosy, but Sam is also very open.
I am. I just really like talking about myself. Maybe it's all the therapy. Anyway. So basically, since connective tissue is everywhere, it affects everything. EDS, I mean. And because of that, I have POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia, which means my brain doesn't talk to my heart the way it should. And you know how, like, when you stand up, sometimes you get a little dizzy? It's that, but, like, every time you move your head, it's great. Mine is actually really well managed. I don't consider it to be an issue for me anymore. I'm not medicated for it. I've just managed it really well through diet and exercise. I've put a lot of effort into conditioning my heart, and it's really fine. The only time I really feel it is if I'm dehydrated. So that's, like, not a huge issue.
That's good.
Right? I love you know, it, none of my things can be cured, but they can be treated and managed, which is really nice. And then gastroparesis is paralysis of the stomach. Along with that, I have intestinal dysmotility, which is the same thing, but with your intestines. So my stomach doesn't move the way it should. And because of that, I have a really hard time digesting things. So I can't digest things like fat or fiber because they take a long time to break down and my stomach just isn't about that.
I'm finding out that I also have a lot of issues with those things, which is really fun.
Mm-hmm. It's super fun. It's like all my favorite foods have something that I can't eat. And sometimes I'm like, you know what? Maybe it'll be worth possibly throwing up. Maybe it'll be worth it. Sometimes I just really want cheese.
I know. I get you. Because when I eat it, then I like regret it, you know, 5 hours later when I still can't eat anything else.
Yeah. You regretty the spaghetti?
You know, spaghetti's actually pretty fine. It's a simple carb.
So you also said that you have a type of immunodeficiency. Is that related to your EDS?
It's related to my RA, which is related to my EDS.
Wait, did you talk about RA before?
A little.
I mentioned it offhand.
Okay. I was like, wait, am I getting completely blindsided by this?
No.
Okay.
My RA actually isn't super bad. From like tests I've had done, it only really affects my hands at this point, and then all the other joint damage in my body is just EDS. But basically, autoimmune disease, your body attacks itself, so obviously there's going to be some fucked up things going on with your immunoglobulin. And IgA is an immunoglobulin or antibody found in the lungs primarily. And last year, I'm trying to remember, yeah, this was last year, I had bronchitis 5 times and I had a pleural effusion and had to get my lungs drained. Basically the walls of the lining of my lungs filled with liquid and it was gross. Because of that, I have pleurisy, which sounds like an 18th century disease. I'm like, ooh, get on the Oregon Trail. But
I only know what that is because it's like on like 1 in 5 like Grey's Anatomy episodes.
Yeah, mine wasn't that dramatic. I just, like, had a really bad cough, and I went to urgent care, and they did an x-ray to see if I had pneumonia, and they were like, oh, there's liquid in there.
That's not good.
And I was like, oh, and then they just, like, drained it, and I was like, okay, and they were like, we're gonna put you on prednisone, and I was like, sick, and then it happened again. So my doctor was like, ooh, and I was also like, ooh, this isn't good. So I got some tests done and it came back that the levels of IgA, which is the lung antibody, are just like really low in my body. So I just am really susceptible to respiratory disease or respiratory illness. And I have had asthma my whole life, so I'm like used to being short of breath constantly. But that was just like kind of the icing on the cake, especially like getting diagnosed with that like 6 months before a massive respiratory illness pandemic.
Yeah, I was about to say, I was like, COVID sounds great for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So honestly, it's not so bad. There's no treatment for it except like treating the like infections. But like I got RSV actually from Rapture in January, and that was rough. But since then, I haven't had any like really bad respiratory infections. I've been pretty good at avoiding it. So I managed to not get COVID, so here we are.
So far.
Can you, like, please knock on wood or, like, I don't know. Thank you.
But, yeah, my lungs don't work, but they're fine.
Who needs lungs?
Right? I wish I was, like, a frog.
And just breathe through your skin?
Yeah, or, like, a bird. Because, like, birds breathe through, like their bones. I mean, they don't breathe through their bones, but they have, like, a really interesting respiratory system that includes their bones.
Isn't there a turtle that can breathe through their butt?
I don't know, but I want that to be true, so I'm going to say yes.
I feel like that's something
we
that...
We actually looked this up once
upon a time. I feel like that's something that your nephew made up, and then you have to accept it as fact.
Okay, we're going to check this out. Turtle...
Oh, it's turtles breathe out of their butt. Technically, the term is called cloacal respiration.
Ew.
It's not so much breathing.
I did it!
So much, not so much breathing as diffusing oxygen and in and carbon dioxide out. That sounds like breathing to
I
me.
Wish I could do that.
Okay, but like, can we just all admit that breathing in through your ass is like the worst idea ever and yes. evolutionarily just terrible? But breathing out would not be the worst idea.
I feel like with how gassy I am, I'd have the most efficient respiratory system.
Apparently, when they hibernate turtles, that's how they breathe, is through their butt.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay, so I wasn't making it up, and my nephew didn't tell me this, so fuck you, Odd.
So anyways, Sam, this is when we like to turn the tables to you and say, ask if you have anything else that you want to talk about, before we finish up.
Yeah. Okay. I have a billion things in my brain, so let me pick one.
pick like half of one.
Okay. Half of
no,
one.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
one thing is, I'm like at this weird place in my life where I've been like struggling with my identity as a disabled person because my mobility is basically normal now. I don't like using the word normal for things like that, but it's the only way I could think of describe it at 9:17 at night. but I like I'm at a place where I can climb stairs for the first time in a very long time, and I haven't had to use a mobility aid full time in over a year, and I haven't really had to use one at all like in the past 6 months. And it's just, like, so weird because I spent so many of my formative years, like, building my identity, like, as, yes, I'm disabled. I am LGBT. And it's, like, I've gone through so many identity changes in the past year, and it's just, like, really weird waters to navigate. And I'm, like, how much is my voice, like, how much should my voice be amplified over other disabled people now? And it's just very weird because, like, chronic illness, being chronically ill and being disabled are two separate things. And I'm, like, okay, am I chronically ill now and like no longer also disabled, and it's just like weird waters to be in. Especially because like identity, like we said at the beginning, is it's putting yourself, it's self-defining, and I'm like, should I still self-define as disabled? And then I really think about it and I'm like, you know what, yes, because regardless of my status of mobility, I still like am extremely limited by society because of like my illnesses. And it's just, it's very weird because like I feel like people have this idea of what disability should look like, and I'm not that.
Yeah, it's like someone who is in, it's like Stephen Hawking, like that's what they expect.
Yeah,
you know, like
right.
And that's not the only thing that can be a disability.
Exactly, like ooh, look at me, I'm learning how to roller skate, I can't possibly be disabled, but that's like not the case.
Well, and it's, I mean, it's like any marginalized group. You're not a monolith. How yeah. you represent is specific and individual to you. So, I mean, like, I totally understand what you're saying, though. But, like, I do think that, again, however you put yourself in the box is going to be what works best for you. But the disability community is not a monolith. And you can't just judge the entire disability community by, like, one disabled person.
Definitely.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Sam. We know you had a lot of fun doing it. If you want to reach out to us, our email is fraupowpodcast@gmail.com, or you can always find us on social media on Instagram and Facebook at fraupowpodcast. And as always, friends, don't be a dick. When you start
that
doing
was not
it.
Bad.
Yeah, we'll see how it sounds.